We have one or two complaints from the back, so it's perhaps best if people would use the microphone.
Okay. And the front, for that matter. Does this work?
Sure not.
Okay. Does this work? At all?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wait.
Okay. So it's great to have followed the panel on deception, and particularly being the talk immediately after Randy's talk on how easy it is to deceive us, and how in the real world, you know, we're so easily fooled all the time. I'm going to come to this from a different perspective, and that perspective is as a computer security person. And of course, you know, computer science is this wonderfully advanced field in which we have had all sorts of tremendous successes building things that change the world. And computer security, the branch that I'm stuck working in, is the one branch of computing that can't say that, right? I mean, we're the part of computer science that is best characterized by utter and consistent failure all the time. Right, we are the famously unsuccessful bad stepchild of this horribly advanced field. So when I look at the real world, I have precisely the opposite reaction from Randy, who sees the real world as being this cesspit of fraud and ease of deception. And I look at that, and I marvel at the fact that we're not always getting killed 100% of the time, and that we ever get to keep any of our money, and that any of you are who I think they are. Because my perspective as a computer scientist tells me that the world is a terribly, terribly hostile place. So what, of course, I'm really getting at is that as computer scientists and as those of us interested in computer security, we could probably learn something from the great successes of the real world at how we're able to protect ourselves. And maybe we can learn something from looking at the protocols and cues that we actually use to protect ourselves a large fraction of the time, at least. Maybe us computer security people are actually spending too much time thinking about computers. And in fact, I think we've developed some methodology and some tools that in fact, may be quite useful, but we don't quite know how to apply them. Similarly, there is wisdom and a tool-making methodology in the real world, a way of evolving secure protocols that we've largely ignored through history. So this will be a very, very quick talk with a couple of examples and no real answers, but a kind of call for a broader view of computer security and computer security protocols, with a couple of suggestions of things to get started to think about. So I'm going to talk specifically about two papers. One I wrote and one I didn't. The one I didn't is one of my favorite papers in computer security. It was Roger Needham from 1994, 14 years ago, on denial of service. And Roger was asked to talk in a keynote address at the first ACM computer security conference about the problem of denial of service. And he realized that he didn't understand it very well in a computing context because it was a very hard problem. So he decided to do something very radical and that surprised everybody in the audience, and talk about denial of service in a very non-computational context. How do you design a good burglar alarm? And he made this observation that was profound to everybody in the room and maybe not so profound to the people who actually deal with alarm systems and physical security. And he observed that there are two ways to attack an alarm system, something that sets off an alarm when it senses an intrusion into a physical space. There's the obvious way, the way that we think of first, which is to attack it directly and prevent the delivery of the alarm signal and interfere with the alarm signal. So cut the wires or send a fake signal to the that says everything is okay. Now, this is so obvious as a way of attacking an alarm system. It's the first thing you would think about in designing an alarm system. And so alarm designers take great pains to make this somewhat difficult to do. A good quality alarm makes it hard to interfere with the signal. If you cut the wires, that causes an alarm to be sent rather than prevents the delivery of an alarm. So this kind of attack A, the first one you think of, is also the first one that we develop countermeasures against, or I should say they developed countermeasures against, because us computer scientists had nothing to do with this. But anybody who's actually interested in burglary understands that immediately and understands that there's another way to attack an alarm system that precisely takes advantage of the countermeasures against attack A, which is to cause alarm signals to be sent in a way that overwhelms the capacity of the responder to respond. So the correct way to burglarize something is not to do a sort of Hollywood, going through the sewer system and cutting the blue wire with little headsets on and, a big bank of computers with tape drives behind you and some spectrum analyzers and oscilloscopes and other blinky things, but rather go up, rattle the door, and this hypersensitive alarm system will cause an alarm signal to be sent. Hide in the bushes while the police come. When the police leave and conclude it's a false alarm, go up, rattle the door, hide in the bushes until the police come, and repeat that until the police stop coming. And if you want to do this a little more quickly, rattle doors all over town with your Confederates so that the police conclude that there's something wrong with the central alarm system and just stop responding altogether. And at that point, once you're confident that the system has been overwhelmed, go in and break the window through the front door, walk in and go out with your international art. Now, everybody who deals with alarm systems understands that trade-off very quickly. But us computer scientists apparently didn't, because after Roger made his observations, which seemed almost trivial from the point of view of the alarm community, but seemed very profound in computer science, internet denial of service attacks started. And lo and behold, how did they do it? Well, they didn't do it by cutting the fiber optic cables going between cities. They do this by overwhelming the capacity of servers and communication links to send traffic, often by compromising the hosts and getting them to run the very protocols that were designed in the first place according to spec perfectly well. So this trade-off, the redundancy of the internet, the ability to route packets to their destination, in fact, to some extent, works against us in being resistant to denial of service. This showed an example of a trade-off that's readily apparent in the real world, but not so obvious in a computational context, which is why this paper had such a strong effect on me and why I recommend that you read it. It's a short, easy paper. So Google Needham denial of service. And definitely take a look at this. That's an example where the real world, the physical world, has something to teach us. And I think there are many, many examples like this. But I'd also like to point out that this can go in the other direction as well. About 10 years after Needham did his work on denial of service, I decided to look at the physical world and, in particular, look at locks from a computational perspective. And so I learned as much as I could about mechanical locks and locksmithing, which is, there's a long tradition here, and at many engineering schools of looking at locks. I came a little late to the party, but I came with it from the perspective of computer security, cryptography, cryptanalysis, and protocol design. And I asked the question, well, what's the computational complexity of attacking locks? And, can we characterize the security of locks as we characterize the security, or try to characterize the security, of cryptographic systems? In fact, according to that kind of an analysis, regular, ordinary locks of the kind you have on your house with a single key that opens them look to be pretty secure. That is, the concept, the abstract design of a lock appears to be quite sound. And the best attack is exhaustive search. There are other attacks, but those attacks don't arise from the design. They arise from the implementation, which is good news because what it says is, improve the implementation, you're done with the design. But master keyed locks, where the janitor has a key that can open all of the doors in the building, you have a key that opens only your own office, turn out to, from a computational point of view, be very, very insecure. It's trivial to use a key that opens your door to build a key that opens all of the doors in the building with much lower cost than exhaustive search. So I published this attack, and I'm going to end by just pointing out the two reactions to this. The first reaction was from the computer science community, which had the reaction of, oh, that's cute. I discovered something kind of like that when I was in graduate school. And I got that reaction from universally across the computer science community. Oh, it's nice to think about this in these terms. And, you know, we had been thinking about this in these terms. This is how I made the key to my dorm, the master key to my dorm when I was in college. You know, some less smart people said, oh, this is how I made the key to my dorm when I was in graduate school. And, you know, I had to wait until I was a professor to figure this out. But, this comes very naturally. And it's also a very natural reaction to publish this sort of an attack because it tells us how to fix these things in the future. And in fact, the design that that was attacked here was, you know, 75 years old, that the master keyed locks had been around. So essentially this flaw had been looming there, and the only people who knew anything about it were computer scientists who were exploiting it in order to get a key to the AV closet, you know, when the secretary was out. But the locksmiths had the reaction that this is really, really sophisticated, because it's much more difficult to see this attack if you think of locks and the physical world. In mechanical terms, computational thinking has some value here, and the abstract thought of computer science actually has some value. So what I'm advocating here is that we look at what I'm calling human-scale security and protocols on the human scale. Let me just leave you with three quotes. It turns out that 150 years ago, the mechanical lock world was much like computer science today. Smart, clever people saw this as a place to tinker. There was a huge community of trying to advance things in this area. Alfred Hobbs, who is my hero, deserves to be yours, was an American locksmith who went to England. The Great Exhibition blew away all of the locks that were available, figured out how to defeat them, and published a book on this. He had a preface in his book that anticipated that some people might find this a little uncomfortable, that there's a respectable book on how to defeat every lock made commercially. But he published it anyway, and, you know, nobody hated him as a result. He included as a preface to his book this wonderfully eloquent quote about how, you know, in the end, an acquaintance with real facts will, in the end, be better for all parties. And this really reflected normal thinking. This could have been written about the internet and computer security as we think about it today. This is the mainstream thinking. The only way you can tell that it wasn't written today is that it's well written. 100 years later, The standard book on safecracking, the art of manipulation by Lentz and Kenton, something went terribly wrong with the physical security world. Exactly 100 years later, they published this book aimed at professional safecrackers, not the criminal kind, but the kind that you can hire if you lose the combination to your safe. They start out their book with the preface, it's extremely important that the information in this book be faithfully guarded so as not to fall into the hands of undesirables. We suggest you become proficient in the art of manipulation and destroy this book completely so as to protect yourself and our craft. Fortunately, not everyone followed this advice. I got my copy from the library. 50 years after that, after I published my master keying paper, Billy Edwards, a prominent locksmith who wrote a book on master keying that I actually cited in my paper that didn't include the attack, wrote in the National Locksmith, a publication that I think didn't realize I was a subscriber, wrote in a guest editorial, Blaise's Master Keen paper shouldn't have been published because the only people it will educate are the dishonest who will use it to compromise security. Locksmiths don't have to be surreptitious. No, we can't call him a moron because he's obviously intelligent. After all, he did grasp the concepts of master keying. We can, however, see that he's an inexperienced amateur when it comes to physical security. In his computerized world, it's a simple thing to fix a security problem. You just load new software. So there's a disconnect here. Between the way we think about the physical world intuitively and the way we think about computer science, this idea that we should attack security as a scientific problem, as an engineering research problem that requires staying a step ahead of the attacker, is in fact one that that has lost favor outside of our community. So we need to do something to bridge that gap and think about these problems a little more broadly. So with that, thanks.
Thanks, Matt. Our next speaker is Ron Clark. He may not be known to many computer security engineers, but he's very well known to architects and the insurance industry and town planners, because he's one of the pioneers of a movement over the last 20 or 30 years to make towns and other physical spaces safer by the way you plan them, design them, and architect them. Something that perhaps we could hope to import some ideas from. Ron.
Thank you very much. I hope you can hear me. Is this thing working? No?
When it rustles.
Oh, wait a minute. On. Well, I'll try and speak up anyway. I'm a criminologist by profession, I'm rather different from most criminologists. First reason is that I'm actually very interested in preventing and reducing crime. Most criminologists are not really that way inclined. They're more interested in understanding and explaining and writing about crime, but I'm very, very firmly focused on trying to reduce it. One of the reasons that I have this particular attitude is that the first part of my professional career was spent working as a government researcher in the Home Office. I was a criminological researcher, and I had to constantly justify my existence by explaining to people how my work helped the government in its thinking about reducing crime. So I'm very grateful for those early years, and I have never given up on this idea that we ought to be focused on reducing crime if we are criminologists. Now, some criminologists are, in fact, interested in prevention and reducing crime, but they mostly focus on changing criminals, trying to somehow deter or reform criminals or prevent people developing into criminals. The approach that I take, that Ross has just referred to, is that is different from that. I'm interested in actually thinking about how to reduce opportunities for crime, how to change the situations that give rise to the opportunities for crime. And I've been doing work in this field for many, many years. I began when I was in the Home Office working on street crimes, burglary, car theft, usual range of ordinary crimes. But more recently, I have moved into a broader range of crimes, organized crime. I've actually done some work on preventing internet sales crime. I've published a book with a colleague called Superhighway Robbery. I have also done some work on terrorism. I've published a book, Outsmarting the Terrorists. Neither of these books are very widely read, but I think it's partly because you know, I'm operating outside the main disciplines which these things are worked on. At the moment, I'm working on how to reduce the illegal trade in Mexican parrots. These are all completely different kinds of crimes, but my approach is always the same. And I'll just give you a quick flavor of what I do in the hope that it relates to some of the things that you're interested in. I've actually developed a classification of opportunity-reducing techniques, and I've given you a handout, it should be on your table, which lists 25 techniques of what's called situational prevention. But the approach I take is as follows, and this is very simple, I hope, and I hope it'll give you a good flavor of what I and other people who work like I do, do. First of all, the key thing is to be very specific. And I think that when we're talking about computer security, the first thing I would do is look very carefully at the particular crimes or problems that we're trying to prevent. I think it muddles up things a lot when we try to think about security very broadly. What are the actual problems that we are trying to deal with? Because every single problem has to be analyzed and understood quite separately. Now, I'm not going to go into the range of problems. You know what they are. I'm not very familiar with all of them. But I think that's absolutely key. Another principle is that it's very important to try to understand what I would call the facilitating conditions for the problem. What is it that makes this crime or problem possible? Now, we have focused early on in the day on the fact that people are easily fooled and that gullible and whatnot. That is one of the facilitating conditions for probably quite a few computer security problems, but it's only one of them. And it's very important to try to understand exactly what is it about the environment in the broadest sense, the computer environment, the internet environment, that provides the conditions for this particular offense or problem to occur. That's another important principle, and it's applied to whatever crime one is looking at. Then the next principle is to try to understand step by step how this is done. How is this particular crime committed? Now, there's a lot of research buried in all of those two assumptions, or in those two approaches. Sometimes it's fairly obvious how it's done. Often it isn't. But the more you understand how it's done, the more points of intervention that you find for reducing the opportunities. It's the same with understanding the facilitating conditions. The more fully you understand those, the better are your chances of finding somewhere that you can intervene to prevent this particular thing occurring. And the interesting thing about this approach is that there's never one way to reduce the opportunities or eliminate the opportunities for a particular form of crime. There's always lots of different ways, and they all have trade-offs and costs, and some of them are difficult to do and some are rather more easy to do, but there are many, many different ways, and sometimes it's better to put together a range of different preventive techniques than to try to rely on one. So those are the basic principles of what I do. Often when I've, in the little I've done looking at crimes on the internet or computer-related crime, it's interesting how simple many of the techniques are. It's often not very complicated stuff that the criminals are doing, and it's often not very complicated how they gain access to the systems and exploit them. Basically, I think the thing to take away from what I'm saying is that it's much better if you're thinking about computer security to try to disaggregate the problems and tackle them one by one. Thanks.
Right, our next speaker, Eric Johnson, is a security economist. He was just chairing the workshop on the economics of information security on Thursday and Friday at Dartmouth last week, where he's at the Tuck Business School. So he brings another interesting perspective on this. Eric.
Thanks, Ross. All right. Well, so I teach in the business school, and I spend much of my time working with large companies and thinking about crime and security from the point of view of a chief information security officer of a Fortune 500 company. And so really all my remarks this morning are from that point of view. And in particular, what I've been doing in the last year or two is trying to help some of these CISOs think about the psychology of their own organizations and how their own organizations fall victim to crimes. And of course, if you talk to many of them, they've known for a long time that the problem is far from technical, that much of the large breaches and problems that large companies face all the time are in the end behavioral the kinds of issues within the organization. And I'm going to come from that point of view. And in particular, I've been studying the last year a particular case study of ChoicePoint, which many of you may be familiar with. ChoicePoint is a large data aggregator. They sell data on you and I to just about anyone. They had quite a famous breach a few years ago. The breach involved about 160,000 Americans, where they sold data on those Americans to organized crime. And that particular breach, which many times was reported as a breach, really not so much a technical hack but an organizational failure, really was one that drove a tremendous amount of activity in the breach notification laws, and was one of the first real test cases through the California breach notification system. And if you were in California, you received a letter like this. And, you know, the story was it was 162,000 folks. It cost them a couple million dollars to do that notification. Their stock lost about 5% of its value the week it was disclosed, nearly 20% by the end of 3 months. And they had to exit some of their business, about 3% of their revenue. They were fined by the FTC on the order of about $15 million. And generated about another $20 million in legal fees. And so, you know, when you looked at ChoicePoint, it was a company that in many ways had a failure and experienced some pretty significant costs. And so my question in studying them was really, what could we learn from this? And what was the psychology of the organization? What were some of the issues around their risk preferences that led them to this place? And many of these things are things that we've known for a while. People who study the kind of psychology of risk, there's great long literature that you really applies here, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but just point out two or three that I think are kind of interesting and relevant, so ideas for the pot, as they were. And they're all to the question of kind of what went wrong, right? So, well, you know, we all know that there are all these judgment biases when people start working around risk and trying to assess probabilities. And many of them are quite famous and very well known. There's some of them that are my personal favorites, you know, like things like, you know, perceptions of the likelihood of event, like the likelihood of being killed by a shark or by a falling airplane part, right? And if you ask most people, I shan't ask this room, but if you ask most people in America this question, they would quite clearly think it's the sharks. Yeah, there's wily sharks are everywhere, and the chance of me getting hit by an airplane part is pretty low. Of course, you know, the reality is that you're 30 times more likely to be killed by airplane parts. And the question is, well, why do we have these very strong biases? And it's a famous phenomenon we call availability, which is the fact that we can't really, many of us, remember too many instances where friends or someone we knew was killed by an airplane part. But we're completely overwhelmed with stories of shark killings. And, you know, just the sighting of a shark, you know, in Florida makes news for days, right? And so there's this constant saturation and availability of this event. And so we'll assess its likelihood much higher. You know, for CISOs and large organizations, this is a real problem because many of the people they work with in their organizations, the people they're trying to help teach about risk, are saturated with stories that many times are misleading in terms of the real risks that the organization face. And, you know, I call it the media-driven availability. And for many large organizations, it's quite extreme, I think. And on the other side, the risk communication that gets done internally is often very poor. In fact, this was one of the better ones I saw in a DHL facility in Prague. They have their information processing data center in Prague now. You know, they have a little banner, then you walk in, reminding you that information is valuable, but it's still just stone boring, unimaginable communication. And I think most organizations are epidemic with boring and unuseful communication coming out of security. And so, in the end, people end up in a very a common kind of situation, often referred to as the limits of imagination by the risk behavioralists. You know, it's this notion that that you know, if you can't really imagine something happening to you, then it's just you're going to assess its probability as being very low. And you know, clearly, for example, when you start walking through these issues around choice point. If when I sat down and started working through the organization interviewing people, I mean, to a person, no one had ever imagined that the enemy, that is the criminal, could be their customer. They had done all kinds of things to harden their networks and their security against all these outside factors. The Russians, hackers in the Netherlands, the Chinese, whoever, you know, lots of different people that they were worried about. They never once had given thought to the idea that their customer, in fact, could be the criminal, and which was the case in their situation. And so much of what needs to be done in these organizations is helping people imagine what could go wrong, to be able to build the scenarios out and imagine them. And, you know, the experimental research on this is so interesting. I mean, you can walk people through a scenario which they had never considered as possible, and then once you've walked it through them, they'll assess the probability of its outcome much higher than if they had never imagined it. Right? Of course, it's not just availability and communication. I mean, in some ways, part of what risk communication suffers from is, you know, something we learned in the business school world a long time ago around marketing. Sometimes it's called vividness, you know, this notion that you need to create concrete, emotional, and interesting or exciting kinds of communications to be able to really influence people to think differently about a problem. And again, in security, we're particularly bad at that. You know, and yet it's important, you know. So one of my favorite ones was this work done by Reyes and friends, where they were looking at vividness in the outcome of different mock trials in a whole set of experiments. And they what they would do is they would take a mock jury and they'd provide them kind of information about a crime. And in one case, they would present kind of what they would say was the vivid version, and the other way, the pallid version. And then they would see how people would assess the guilt or innocence of the individual. So, for example, in one particular set of experiments, they were looking at a case where it was a DUI incident, drunk driving home from the Christmas party, and the defendant collides with a garbage truck. And in the pallid version of the prosecution, they might go something like this. On the way out the door, Sanders staggered against the serving table, knocking a bowl over to the floor, right? The vivid version would be something like this. On the way out the door, Sanders staggered against the serving table, knocking a bowl of guacamole dip onto the floor and splattering guacamole onto the white shag carpet, right? The detail, the imaging, the, you know, connecting to what people could see and think. And it would radically change the way the jurors would perceive the guilt or innocence. And, of course, it works on the defense, too, right? The owner of the garbage truck admitted under cross-examination that the garbage truck is difficult to see at night because of its gray in color. Right? That's the pallid version. Whereas the vivid version was, the owner said of his trucks are gray because it hides the dirt. And he said, what do you want me to do? Paint them pink, right? You want them pink? So, again, you know, it's this kind of notion of vividness. And it really would change outcomes. And the same is true in communication. I think there's a few kind of interesting places to look of analogous kinds of issues. And one of my favorites is inside of Toyota. Toyota, you know, really revolutionized quality in the automotive industry. And I think in many ways they did understand a lot of psychology around the workforce. And even simple things like, for example, quality, you know, in the Toyota system, they would do quality audits and they would bring the whole team together from the assembly line to do the audit of the car after it had been produced, pick through everything, see every issue that was going on. Whereas, how often does that happen in security audits? Yeah, it's often done in the back room. Nobody kind of knows what happens. Here's the result at the end. The people involved often never see what really went on. Or, the kinds of cases where you have an incident, but it really gets kind of swept under the rug. One place where I kind of tried this myself this last year was with some research I was doing around leakages, information leakages in large banks. And for those of you that were at Weiss last year, you know, I presented a bunch of research around this. We were looking at leaks in peer-to-peer music file systems of documents coming right out of the banks. That is, people, users of peer-to-peer, LimeWire, Kazaa, in banks, but not just sharing their own music, but sharing all kinds of documents related to banks. And we found tons of stuff. And we also found that there were lots of different kinds of finders looking for that stuff, and that not all the finders are the same. And some of them were searching very specifically for the stuff that was out there. And that, of course, caught a lot of people's attention because we kind of ranked the banks and showed which banks were losing lots of stuff and how it was being exploited. And so I got invited to go testify about this. And as we were getting ready for this, I was trying to think, how can I really make this vivid, right? So to make it really vivid, we spent about a week looking for some information on Chairman Waxman, because I figured if I could bring something from Chairman Waxman, show the audience, that would be vivid. People would do it. And sure enough, we found this wonderful confidential memo that had been written to him only a couple months earlier, floating around on the peer-to-peer. It was written from an earlier hearing that he had conducted from one of the defendants, clearly marked confidential. And floating around. And of course, that's very vivid, right? Yeah, suddenly everybody got it. Yeah, oh my goodness, yeah, this stuff really does get out there. It really can affect you, right? Well, there's many others. I'll share you kind of one more and then rest my case for the day. You know, there's this whole phenomenon of social loafing and what we call bystander intervention. Yet another area that I think is epidemic in security context, information security context. And again, I think Toyota is a good place to look for some hints about how to change the way people think in an organization. You know, if you walk into a Toyota factory, like for example in Georgetown, Kentucky, or if you go to Japan, you'll see everywhere these little ropes hanging from the ceilings. They're called andon cords, and it's part of an idea that Toyota calls Jidoka, which is quality at the source. And the idea is that that employees, if they see a quality problem, are immediately to pull the cord. And that, in fact, sets off a series of events that will shut the line down. This idea, when it rolled into the U.S., was just revolutionary. That is, the folks at GM, Ford, executives across the board could never imagine providing that kind of empowerment. That was just insane, right? And they figured, well, if this cord is there, everyone's going to pull it, right? No work will ever get done. And I must admit, when I'm in these facilities, sometimes I have to put my hands in my pockets because there's something in me, right? You know, I was on a train last summer, my wife and I traveling in Australia, and I saw this one. I took a picture of it because I just liked it so much. I mean, look at that. Penalty for improper use, $10. And my wife looked at me. She said, no, no, no. And I said, but it's $10. $10 Australian. I want to see if this thing stops, right? Of course I didn't. But what was happening in Toyota? Well, what Toyota had done was they had reversed what was believed to be important. You know, workers in a GM facility were driven by productivity, and management was there to control quality, right? Toyota reversed that, and they said, your job as a worker is to control quality. We'll make sure productivity stays high by fixing the quality problems. And I think we're very much in that same trap. If this room were filled with CISOs and I asked them that question, the agreement would be widespread that their job is just simply to make everyone secure, which is an impossible task, right? It's something that has to go through the whole organization. Well, you know, we could go on and on with all kinds of different perceptions and risk biases. The one I think that's kind of interesting is this one about where the decision gets made. And this is the last point I'll make. One of the real failures in Choice Point was that it had grown very rapidly, and it was a very decentralized organization. And so in the end, you had many, many small business divisions making risky decisions. Many of them based on maybe what would be rational trade-offs within the context of their small division. But in the particular case that caused the failure, they had a very small part of their business that was working, selling personal information of you and I to smaller businesses, and they were making much riskier bets on the quality of those businesses. And in the end, that took Choice Point down, right? The question to think in an organization is, which risks do you centralize versus decentralize? And we can leave that for a point of discussion. Where did Choice Point end up? Well, if you've been following them since the breach, of course, they did take quite a pounding for quite a long time. That's their stock versus the S&P since the breach in 2005. Until recently, of course, when they were just sold to Nexus.
Sociology at Yale, well known for his book on normal accidents and his work on complexity in large, complex, tightly coupled organizations. Charles.
Yeah, how does this work?
The microphone's hanging out the front.
Sorry?
You made it accidentally complex.
Oh.
Worry about that. That's all right.
Yeah, it's in the lodge.
There we are.
Thank you, Ross. Is that working? Good. Something different. Not about users, but about organizations and their structures. Software failures are inevitable, but given software's overwhelming presence in so much of our life, it's remarkable that the failures have done so little damage. Even our critical infrastructure has had very few catastrophic software failures that, for instance, could kill hundreds in one blow. There's been none. However, faulty software is made possible. Cyber financial crime, cyber spying, which we haven't talked about, where governments spy on each other and firms spy on competitors. It's a big business. And has the potential to create cyber terrorism that could disrupt our critical infrastructure. These three dangers are made possible by connecting electronic systems to the public internet. Faulty code is so consequential on the internet because it can be used strategically to do damage, while faulty code in standalone systems has no strategic agent to exercise that code. Strategic intentional damage through the internet is possible because of a system configuration. First, there is high concentration in the operating system market. Windows has over 90% of operating systems. Next, the internet has dispersed and unorganized users, unable to demand either higher reliability or security from Microsoft. Next, the software industry is unusual in that the vehicle of malware is users who do not directly suffer from the malware. There is also the unwillingness of malware targets to admit their vulnerability, and thus a highly incomplete database of successful malware attacks. We really don't have a very poor idea of that. There is the difficulty of determining just what software failed and of finding the source of its exploitation, and thus little chance of establishing penalties or liability suits for this. These are all industry characteristics. Finally, there is the difficulty of regulating the practices of the concentrated provider or the dispersed users, most of which users are unwitting vehicles for the propagation of the malware. Now, many of these system characteristics are associated with integrated architectures as contrasted to modular architectures. The old Ford Motor Company, which owned its own steel mills and its own ore fields and outsourced almost nothing, is an example of a fully integrated architecture. Today's Toyota is an example of a modular firm dealing with thousands of suppliers. Many industries today, such as furniture, machine tools, wool garments, packaging machines, small motors, and so on, are organized as networks of independent small firms competing very successfully with and often replacing the large vertically integrated firms of the past. These are engaged in modular production, the small firms, with one of their members bringing the modulars all together as the final product. Integrated architectures have many advantages if the product is fully understood, standardized, mass-produced, and allowing a linear production sequence. And it can be tightly coupled to speed production. But there are exceptions. If there are exceptions or interruptions or unpredicted failures, the integration allows the propagation of errors and may bring down the whole system. When the Ford Motor Company had to change its Model T to meet the competition, the whole assembly line had to be rebuilt over many, many months. Modularized Toyota can bring out substantially new models without missing a step in production. Now, modularization has its own costs. An interface must be designed so that the modules interact properly with other modules. Time to build is longer because of the extra steps of interface design, and the assembly costs are a bit higher. Worse yet, your competitors may sell their own modules to run on your system if the interface's standards are given or can be discovered by the competitors. Or the firm that makes your modules may sell them to your competitors, or even go into competition with you to make the final product. So there's problems with modularity. The classic article by Herb Simon, The Architecture of Complexity, illustrates well the advantages of modularity under conditions of uncertainty. One watchmaker assembles the whole watch all at once, reaping the benefits of mass production and standardization. The other watchmaker assembles it in the form of modules, incurring the cost of designing standardized interfaces and having more assembly tasks to perform. But if the first watchmaker is interrupted, he has to start all over. The second has only to start over on one module. Microsoft, like Ford with the Model T, envisioned a world with few interruptions. But when it connected to the internet, strategic malware that could exploit its faulty code appeared, and it suffers continuous interruptions, requiring extensive patches that users are unable or reluctant to apply. Microsoft's operating system architecture is less modular than that of its tiny competitor, Apple, although I just have observed that it's not a tiny competitor in this room. Most of the machines are Apple. That's very interesting in this place. Okay? And Microsoft is much less modular than all open source operating systems. And its applications are less modular than open source applications.
Charles, actually, it's modular, but it's not encapsulated. So everything depends on everything else.
I'm going to deal with that.
They would claim it's modular, but it doesn't do them any good because it's not encapsulated.
Wait for my next sentence, which deals with the encapsulation problem. Recent comparisons of propagation errors or threat exposure by McCormick and Associates dramatically makes this point. A fault in integrated architectures can propagate much more widely than in modular architectures. Strategic adversaries, such as cyber thieves and cyber terrorists, can exploit a fault, even one in a third-party application, in such a way as to exploit the fault in Windows, allowing them to burrow into the kernel and take control of the operating system. Mozilla had many error propagation costs. It's proprietary, not open source. Had many error propagation costs until it redesigned its system to be very modular, and it became much more modular than Apple or even some Linux systems. Open source software is inevitably modular since it is built by dispersed independent software writers and has to be built in modules. And Ubuntu, for example, is exceedingly secure as well as very reliable. Now, it does not matter how secure a firm's internal system is, such as its enterprise system, using reliable code from SAP, IBM, or Cisco, if it connects to the internet. And increasingly, enterprise systems in our critical infrastructure utilize Windows to connect. Firewalls are often inadequate or absent. Firms are reluctant to patch daily or weekly because of the disruption to production and the uncertainty about how the patch will interact with in-house software. And there is the sheer cost of patching, which is extensive. What's the answer to all this? Unfortunately, the U.S. government is moving in the reverse direction. Rather than demanding that new and upgraded systems should be open source, as Massachusetts is trying to do, we have Windows for warships. Worse yet, they recently took the excellent decentralized open source medical records and medical services systems used by the Veterans Administration and said that it had to be centralized by a proprietary firm using proprietary software. The consequences of, this is the U.S. government, the consequences of the switch from open to closed source software was a series of outages over the next few months, and then finally, but not finally, we're going to have more of them, a crash that took down 17 facilities for a full day. And this is serious because this is medical treatment, drug ordering, pharmaceutical histories, and so forth. 17 facilities for a full day and required weeks to retrieve vital data. The U.S. government accounts for more than 40% of software sales. They could save a great deal of money and achieve a much higher level of security if they required that open source systems be used. The root of most, not all, of our internet security problems lies in the architecture that Microsoft chose for understandable commercial competitive reasons. I think that many of the papers of this conference will be searching under the wrong lamppost by looking at users and their psychology. Thank you.
Who's in a position to do something about it. Alma, as many people here know, was an author of one of the seminal papers in security usability with Doug Tiger when she was a research student at Berkeley. She wrote the paper Why Johnny Can't Encrypt, which persuaded everybody that user interfaces of the systems we then had available were lousy. And now she's putting that into practice by being the security manager at Google. Alma.
One of the issues of doing that kind of research, of trying to create behavioral models inside of computer games, from the federal point of view, and for universities they too know, is the problem of getting informed consent and an institutional review board. For those of you who have not suffered, but this is an ethical requirement. People got killed by medical research, and it is now plugged down into incredibly foolish applications. But how do you get informed consent of a World of Warcraft user who is ready? You don't click on anything to get into the World of Warcraft. I know one person at one university managed to get that, but to get permission to do that sort of experiment, at least particularly from the government side, is very hard and tricky, and it gets you in conflict with Congress, who worries about Big Brother looking over your shoulder. And I tried to do it in DARPA. I'll tell you all kinds of clever things we thought we could do, and the boss finally said, no, I'm not going to risk my organization getting cut off by Congress again. That's one of the roadblocks.
If you weren't trying to go for the purely statistical, people who get keylogged are very, very interested in finding out what happened.
Yes.
So I could imagine that, for example, if one were to provide a service that would try to analyze and figure out what happened, and as part of the click-through for that, would say, would you allow us to collect information? We might get a fair amount of buy-in.
One trick is to say, I'm only observing, and I will make sure the names get lost.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute you make a change to say, can I now induce a particular behavior by changing the world, then you're stuck with the whole human use problem.
Andrew?
That's a question and a general comment. Since you responded very well to some of the things that he said, in particular going back to the presentations of Beth and Charles, was a little bit of a opposition to the American interpret them in different ways. Much of what's been happening over the last decade or more, I think, can be viewed as a kind of reversal of the traditional kind of approach of the technologies. The idea being that we're going to create this pure new cyberspace where all the kind of human imperfections will go away, lawyers, policemen, censorship, etc. And a wonderful example that perhaps the best example of all is the famous Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace by Jean-Pierre Darwin, used to represent former lyricist for the Grateful Dead as a way with language, take some beautiful phrases, cite a few of them, says,
cyberspace consists of transactions, relationships, and thought itself arrayed like a standing wave in a web of goods. Microsoft can't be off the place. We are the standing wave in the web of our communications. Ours is a world that is both everywhere and nowhere, but it is not where bodies live. And in such a world, indeed, you go in there and kill something, steal some passwords, and you can indeed also kill some others, in fact. And what really keeps us secure is the fact that we can actually hide in such a space to the alternative physical world. And so, in fact, I think what we can think of is the best decades is a reversal. Instead of building this new world which avoids the perfections of the physical world, instead what we've learned is, first of all, we cannot build such a world. Second, if we did build it, we could live with it. As you mentioned, this issue of people tailgating, getting through, etc. And example I have to cite is that the problem with secure signatures is that secretaries should not forge their boss's signatures, which would then bring down possibly large bureaucratic organizations. So the second point. And the third point is that instead what's happening is that we're kind of using all the protective mechanisms of the ordinary physical world to compensate for the imperfections of cyberspace. And many of the imperfections that we see are in fact become features, is that the modules is a feature. So going back to Charles' presentation, he talked about modularity. So and how the spaghetti code of certain companies that we do not name here, etc., is all the horrible. Well, not necessarily all the horrible. Think about 10 years ago was a famous antitrust suit brought against Microsoft at that time. And for a while it looked like it was going to come out very nicely for Microsoft, and various remedies were being proposed. One of the remedies that was quite seriously being discussed was to be forced to license a source code for Windows, so that other companies like IBM, Sun, etc., could go on and build their own competing Windows for future generations of Windows. That fell down into the big thumb. There was no interest in whatsoever. Why? And I'm not privy to any internal deliberations, but my guess is those companies figured out, most surely correctly, by the time they figured out how that code works, to be totally obsolete. There is an advantage to spaghetti code. And if you look at what some of the most interesting lessons to be learned is from developers of some of the malware or other kind of systems. It's spaghetti code. It's very complicated. But look at these rootkits. They leave all sorts of things inside. They have all sorts of kinds of things. They are not modular. Yes, all the tenets of software engineering about building nice modular systems, they are all very well and good, but they often go counter to all the incentives just the system. And in fact, I think what we should be learning from is very often is malware writers. The reason that so much of our society, of our technology systems keep operating in a really secure way is that precisely they're not modular. If they're modular, somebody who figures out how to subvert some password or project code of some particular code, which gives them good access or some other privileges, could then destroy the whole system. And practice doesn't happen. And to a large extent, it is precisely because we live in a world of identity code. So many of the things that I have personally strongly believed were kind of very wrong, like spaghetti code and security for obscurity, I think actually have a lot of sense to that.
David, please stand up. A brief comment. I'd like to address Eric's presentation. Starting with your discussion of vividness, of course, that's spot on. If we want people to pay attention to something, we've got to tell a story. We've got to tell a story that engages their sensory modalities, which activates belief. I think there's some interesting reasons for that. That takes me to your lovely example earlier on the differential perception of the danger of shark attacks falling airplanes. And of course, as you say, availability bias plays a role there, but I think there's something else that plays a role there. which is the fact that we human beings are disposed to be frightened of predators. It's part of our deep history, it's part of our composition. We are not disposed to be frightened of airplane parts falling from the sky. Jaws was a terrific, engaging movie because it tapped that fear of predators. And a comparable film about falling airplane parts. So I think there's a very important story to be told there about what you need to appeal to if you want people to be alarmed about something. You have to appeal to human nature.
Of course, only the tribe, right? Snakes on a plane, right?
Yeah.
Sharks on the plane. Yeah, it's struck by the synergy between Elmer's talk and Matt's, and actually Charles's as well. What Matt was saying was, look, you might learn a lot by looking at systems which oughtn't to work out in the world. There's, I mean, human bodies, human societies work at, against all the odds. They work, and we're beginning to understand now why. Well, everything was ought to bring them down, like the selfishness of selfish genes and the selfishness of economic rational men who are working for maximizing resources have been, in the context of the larger organism, being tempered and controlled by the cooperative structures which get set up. Also, why modularity has won out in terms of evolution and development, because modular systems turn out to be failed to be protected against the sorts of failures evolution discovered modularity a long time ago. But in particular, in relation to Elmer and Elmer's presentation, I thought it was a wonderful demonstration of how, as an organization like Google, has rediscovered something which anthropologists might have told us a long time ago, or at least not so long ago, it's only recently beginning to really understand it, which is how human selfishness and human tendencies to be suspicious and to mistrust of each other and to locks towards cooperation can be overcome in an open enough environment in which people reputation is on the line, where everybody knows a great deal about everybody else, where hierarchies are not allowed to develop, where the opportunities for the running system are increasingly made punishable by detection and so on, because of the structures which are set up and what people can expect to work down. I think that Elmer's description of people was a model of what people have now discovered about themselves and life. It's very close to what people have discovered about the structure of hunter-gatherer society, and absolutely the opposite of our hunter-gatherer societies, which have come out of the first agricultural, first industrial societies. And I think it's really interesting to think how to Ron's example that we, our societies work because on the whole, people don't want to commit crime. And they don't want to commit crime because they benefit from very clear evidence around them that those who the nice guys finish first, as Richard Dawkins put it. And that's a lesson which we ought to take on continually, that we're not in the business of trying to control criminals, we're trying to promote decent behavior. And it's much, in the end, much the most likely to be effective defense.
Sorry, do you want to
build
on the brief?
It's kind of a follow-up to that question, it turns out. So I kind of have a question for Eric. I'm not an economist, so let me just be an amateur economist and assume that we want to build systems that incent good behavior, right? That's kind of where my economic understanding ends. But I was looking at your choice point example that you ended up. And, you know, you describe this company dealing with highly sensitive personal information, doing what, you know, to me sounds like the equivalent of murder in that world, right? Which is selling personal information to the mafia. Sounds pretty bad to me, intuitively. And that should be, you know, by kind of, you know, by analogy, that's
kind of the thing that should give you the equivalent of the death penalty in that world. And what you described was they paid a few million dollars out of I'm not sure how much, and their stock price slid a little bit, and then they got bought by someone. That sounds like they made a rational business decision to engage in that behavior. They may have misestimated the price of getting caught or how much diligence they needed to do, but it didn't sound like the consequences were at all proportional to the damage. Am I wrong there?
Well, I mean, in the sense that, you know, if you look at the organization, I mean, they lost a lot. I think they did lose a lot. They lost a couple of years in business where they could have done a lot more. And all for what was a very little bit of revenue. So, you know, in the sense that, yeah, you're right. What one part of the organization did was go off and sell to small businesses that they weren't able to fully credentialize, and they turned out to be organized crime. Was that dumb? Yes, it was really dumb. Was it dumb that was, you know, allowed to happen in an environment where here's one little piece of the organization that can put the whole rest of the organization at risk? That's the, in my mind, the real takeaway. Really dumb, right? Were they penalized enough, right? There's a lot of debate on that.
So you don't think that there was a rational business decision that would say do it again?
No, okay. No. I mean, this part of the organization that they quite rationally quickly closed. You know, it was a nice PR move for them because they said, look, we're going to exit this whole piece of the business of selling to small businesses where the breach had occurred. It played well, but it also was completely rational. It was a small part of the business, relatively low revenue, expensive business. It was hard to credentialize the clients, and then the clients ended up being criminals anyway. So that was not rational. It should not have been in that business.
Well, that's interesting because I think in many parts of Europe, your credit reference agencies and others will still sell to essentially all comers because it's just so expensive to tell good businesses from bad businesses, if you recall Ben Edelman's paper on adverse selection and online trust. But in any case, that may be getting us off to the side of it. Dick, you haven't spoken yet.
Yeah, I was going to say, we shouldn't be taking what happened to Choice Point as being indicative of whether it was a good or bad decision or pure money maximizing thing. Presumably, they wouldn't have engaged in this behavior. They thought there was more than one chance in 20 that maybe they caught. So for everyone who gets caught, there are 19 to get away. Actually, there are more than 19 to get away. If what economists would say is consumer surplus, they only have one chance in 50 of getting caught. So my guess is that there may very well be an incentive for lots of companies to engage in somewhat lax behavior. Who knows if there's a small chance that they'll get caught, their stock price will suffer. And that's okay. And I think the best example of that occasionally you get a big problem, that's the subprime crisis. Where people engaged in poor security and not investigating things themselves. You know, some people like Harris Turner's or 3.5% of that.
Well, trying to the question that you hear in Berkeley on the
chat. Yeah, it's basically a question that's puzzled me for a long time, and it's kind of become more focused from all the introductions, which is this. Online crime is different to offline crime in one very important sense, which is that a long time before online crime occurs, it's sometimes already conceptualized by people working in the field. So, for example, I've been reading books about cyber terrorism now for a very, very long time. I'm still waiting for it to happen. And quite often, you read, you know, sort of all these things that are going to occur online, you know, sort of. All this assurance and authority that have no doubt about it. It's only a matter of time before this will occur. The question I have is, to what extent is there not a danger that in the very pursuit and the conceptualization of online crime, we actually create a self-fulfilling prophecy whereby we almost kind of invite people to commit those crimes in the way that we're proceeding?
So, let me just respond to that. Two things. First, that question of there seems to be this honeymoon period between the time when we discover something is possible and the time people exploit it. That's a good question. I've got a student looking at that right now for her thesis work, and we don't have any answers yet. But I mean, I will say that there is, you know, as an engineer and as a scientist, what my gut reaction to this
is that it's kind of the height of arrogance to make the assumption that we understand how to attack these systems better than the attacker, and that we're going to give them ideas by publishing this. In fact, you know, the attackers have a full-time job of looking at this. This is a part-time job for our community. We build vulnerabilities much faster than we discover them and fix them. To say that we understand this and they don't is probably fooling ourselves. I think one way we can tell the difference between the attackers and the good guys is the good guys, when they discover a problem, will tell everyone about it, and the bad guys will keep it themselves and exploit it. So, you know, I mean, that's a simplistic answer, but I found that to be a useful moral compass for me.
Anyone else?
Just a comment on the crime issue. There's an OECD report that just recently came out by Nanette and Johannes Bauer, which reviews some of this, and also Symantec semi-annual report. And credit card theft is declining, so that it's almost an insignificant portion of expense to the companies that have to pay the expense, whereas credit card use and the profits they're making for credit cards is increasing very fast, still increasing. The same is true with online fraud for bank accounts. It has increased, and if it's your bank account, it's your bank, because you probably won't pay, the bank will, you'll be inconvenienced. The bank is paying a lot, but electronic banking is increasing much faster than electronic fraud. My real puzzle is, if it's as easy as everybody seems to say, even if it's a full-time job, but it's still easy to do, you can buy these kits on the internet, you can buy from $10 to $100 it costs, according to the OECD report, to buy a bank account number and password and mother's maiden name and so forth. If it's that easy, why do not we not have vastly more online fraud? It's going up, but the use of the online system is going up much faster. It's a puzzle to me.
Well, I suppose we should probably end at that point, as we've gone 15, 20 minutes late this morning. Let's get back at 2 o'clock, shall we? After lunch. Lunch is here, isn't it?
Yeah. Lunch is here. There's the sandwiches are actually half sandwiches, so there should be enough for two piece at least. The veggie one is going to be over to the left in a minute.
Right, so we'll see everybody back at 2 o'clock, but let's thank the speakers for the time.
Why did they run slow?